So good evening, everyone. And so today I'm going to continue with the theme that I've done the last 3 weeks, and the theme of self, not self, selfing, unselfing. And hopefully I still have your interest in this topic. It's a very personal topic, of course. And so you should all be very interested, I would imagine, in principle. So the question is, the topic has to do with self. And it's one that is addressed by many different philosophers, many different religious teachings, by many psychologists. It seems like such a very central category for human beings, the idea of a self, and myself as a self, and all that. And then the Buddha has this teaching that appears almost like a basic foundation of his teaching, which is a teaching of anatta. And anatta is sometimes translated into English as the teaching of no self. And then people are perplexed. No self. I mean, I'm here, you're there, there's a self. All my philosophy books have talked about self. All my psychologists have talked about self. And Buddhism says there's no self. And someone, of course, has to be wrong. So it turns out that the Buddha never said or taught that there is no self. It's a easy thing to pick up when you kind of talk quickly or hear very quick teachings of Buddhism. There is no self. And you find actually a lot of great Buddhist teachers who actually say there is no self. And then you'll ask, well, how can that be? And then they'll come up with various logic or philosophies or ways of looking at reality that somehow will tell you there is a self and there isn't a self. Conventionally, there is a self, but ultimately, there is no self. And that's kind of a philosophy. And there's two different levels or realms of reality, or realms of discourse, ways of talking. And one is conventional. We use concepts and conventions. And the other is more ultimate, how things actually are. But if you take the Buddhist teachers who say there is no self and take that for face value, and then go back and try to find the Buddha saying that there is no self, you won't find that at all. And so then it's kind of perplexing. Here, the founder of the religion never said that, and people attribute it to him all the time. And so what's that about? There was only one time in the record, and the records are quite extensive. There's something like, I don't know how many volumes. All the records together of what survives supposedly of Buddhist teachings would probably be in about 5 or 6, maybe 7 books this size. There's a lot. And only once in all this record did someone actually ask the Buddha, is there no self? Is there no self? And in a sense, unfortunately for us, he remained silent. So, finally someone's going to try and pin him down. What is this about this no self teaching? I've read all these books. I went down to Kepler's, I bought all these books on Buddhism, and they say there's no self. And I finally get to ask you, is there no self? And the Buddha just didn't answer. So what goes on? What's happening there? Before I go much further, I wanted to read you a quote that I found one day when I was walking in downtown San Jose. I don't know San Jose very well anymore. But somewhere in the very central part of San Jose, there's this kind of pedestrian walk area. And on there, engraved on a bench or on a cement, I forget anymore, so many years ago, but either engraved on a bench or engraved somewhere on a piece of stone, was this quote by Ernesto Maybe someone knows the quote. You've seen it down there? Ernesto, his name is Ernesto Galarza. Galarza? It's familiar to anyone? I figured he was famous or important in San Jose. I don't know who he is. Anybody? He says, possibly the self not being fundamental. That caught my attention. You know, down there in San Jose. I don't think this guy had studied Buddhism. Possibly the self not being fundamental breathes out on the incidental. I don't know what that means. But I can imagine what it means. But the fact that someone else would say, you know, the self is not fundamental. And each of us takes ourselves as being so fundamental, so fundamentally important. But the self is not fundamental. Breathes out on the incidental. So I like the idea that they have the breath in there, because that seems pretty Buddhist, focusing on the breath. And the first breath, self is not fundamental, and breath, that's good. And then San Jose. And then breathes out on the incidental. And breathes out on the incidental. Incidental, for me, I take it to be just the details of life. Each moment, each detail, each event in itself, the self breathes out. Everything ends on the out-breath. Everything begins on the next in-breath. The world gets born moment by moment. And that's a kind of very deep, I think, experience some people can have, that moment by moment, the whole world we live in, somehow or other, ends, and the next moment it begins. It starts all over again. And mostly we have a sense of tremendous continuity all the time. We carry ourselves, we carry our history, we carry everything with us down through time. And nothing really changes. So that, you know, this self of ours, we take it so solid often. So the Buddha didn't teach that there was no self. So there's no record of that at all. But he did teach anatta. And anatta should not be translated as no self, but rather should be translated as not self. And you might think, well, that's a subtle distinction, but it's a hugely important distinction. To say there is no self is to make a metaphysical claim, an ontological claim, a claim about reality as it is. Whenever the Buddha taught about not self, it was always qualifying something, was always describing something, characterizing something. So when you say not self, it's implying that something is not self. So not self, the not self teaching is a teaching about things. That things, certain things are not self. Certain things are not self. We can breathe out, yes?
I heard a comedian that made a song to this sound. And so each thing is, I am your car, I am your car.
So the teaching on not self is, like water is wet. So wetness is a characteristic of water. In a sense, you don't have wetness without a liquid. Without, you can just go along with me, without water. So if there's water, then there's wetness. If there's wetness, there's water, there's liquid. So water, wetness is a characteristic of water. I suppose there's a lot of things that you would say only exist as a characteristic of something. They don't have an independent existence. So color, for example, in nature, color, I don't think color exists in nature in some kind of way, right? And you can argue that color doesn't exist at all. It's kind of amazing, like, you know, colorful world we live in. But it's just kind of amazing, the mysterious process that I don't think people really understand. Why these waves, light waves, as they come and hit our retina and go into our brain, they get translated into these particular colors. I mean, we know about the waves and how the colors correspond to different wave frequencies and all that. But why they should be interpreted or seen or in the mind as being blue or red, you know, that's kind of a little bit of a mystery. But, you know, in nature, color doesn't exist apart from something which has that color. So color is generally a characteristic of something. So the not-self teaching, not-self is a characteristic of things. So then the question is, what things is a characteristic of? So certain things are not-self. So the Buddha would say, this body is not-self. Your feelings are not-self. Your perceptions are not self. Your intentions, your impulses, your thoughts are not self. Your consciousness is not self. He would never say there is no self, but he points to certain things which these things don't qualify as a self at all. Don't take them as a self. There are examples in the discourses of very accomplished meditators, some of the Buddha's most accomplished students, very accomplished in meditation, deep spiritual life. One of them in particular, thinking of now, who was very deeply attained in meditation, but he was still not liberated. And he went and talked to, I think, Sariputra, another disciple of the Buddha, and said, look, I've practiced very deeply, very seriously. I come to this very deep states of meditation where I'm really still. But still, even with that stillness, I haven't still been liberated. And he was instructed and say, when you're talking, when you're having these experiences, and when you talk about it, there's a lot of self in there. I've gotten this deep attainment. I've gotten this. I haven't reached this final level of liberation. It's all kind of done through the reference of I. So he was kind of, that was pointed out to him, and then he went back to meditation and stopped referencing things to the self, some self that was experiencing it all. And that's what he needed. That was the little key he needed to kind of finally experience his realization, his liberation. Somehow stop the constant referencing of the experience through the filter of self. This is happening to me. That last little piece of self-consciousness. So a little bit, this is what I talked about last week. Was I tried to talk last week, you know, that all these things that don't qualify as a self. It turns out that you can't find anything. If you pay very careful attention, you can't find anything as being the definitive thing that you can say, this is who I am. But to say that this is not who I am, this particular thing, and the fact that you can't find anything which is not any, you know, this is not who I am, doesn't translate to saying there is no self. Just means you can't find it anywhere. In any kind of empirical experience, you cannot find a self. And then you can find, well, empirical experience, that's, you know, for light weights or something, you know. You know, really, we have to intuit some kind of metaphysical self that's beyond empirical experience. And that's what some people do. There's some kind of self that's beyond, you can't see it, you can't feel it, you can't somehow have contact with it, but you kind of, your logic or your intuition tells you it's there. And I think that also the Buddha said, then it's not, he didn't say this exactly, this is my kind of follow up on that, is that then it's not relevant. If it's outside of your experience, then it's not really relevant. Because what's relevant for the Buddha is very much the world that you can experience. Because the Buddha was trying to address issues in our life that have to do with what we can actually experience. That was the domain, the realm the Buddha was trying to address. And what he was trying to address in particular was suffering. How we suffer. And how to be free of suffering. So there's, I think, kind of a wonderful discourse of the Buddha where he talks about how to pay attention to things wisely and how to pay attention to things unwisely. Or another way of saying it is what questions you should ask in your practice life. If you want to become liberated, you engage in a spiritual practice of looking deeply. But looking deeply needs, in a sense, to be informed by certain questions of what you're looking for. And you have to ask the right questions. So if you ask the question, if you become a naturalist, a zoologist, and your whole life is dedicated to study of zoology, to animals, but what you really want to discover is a white unicorn, you could spend, you know, a whole career and never find one because you're asking the wrong question. Unicorns don't exist, so looking for the white unicorn is not going to get you the right thing, the right answer. You have to have the right question, you know, more or less, in order to know what to look for. So to ask, you know, what is the self in some essential, true, ultimate way, the suggestion in Buddhism is that kind, a little bit like a unicorn. To look for the self is a little bit, won't find it. That's the wrong question to ask. And there's a lot of questions that go together with the question of self, that are connected to self questions, that the Buddha considered to be unwise, not useful questions to have. So here's a list of these kinds of unwise, unuseful questions. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else the person is inwardly perplexed about the present in the following way. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So that's kind of a big list. What's left? What can you ask about? What can you ask about yourself? When a person attends unwisely in this way, one of six views can arise. The view, self exists for me, arises as true and established. Or the view, no self exists for me, arises as true and established. Or the view, I perceive self with self, arises as true and established. Or the view, I perceive not self with self, arises as true and established. Or the view, I perceive self with not self, arises in him as true and established. Or else he has some such view as this. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. These speculative views are called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, the common person is not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, and is not freed from suffering. So, nowhere do you find the Buddha teaching that there is a self, and nowhere do you find him teaching there is not a self. And in fact, in this discourse, he very clearly suggests, don't bother with, he clearly says that the view, the philosophy, the idea that there is a self, or the view, the idea that there is no self, both are should be avoided. Both of them are philosophical nightmares. You know, if you start questioning and looking and analyzing deeply what's behind any kind of claim, this is the self, or this is there is no self, you know, it's just, you know, it's a thicket of views. You'll get into this maze of philosophy if you, and there's no way out. So then the question is, what's the alternative? And this is really the climax of the talk, or even the climax of these last 3-4 weeks. What is the alternative What's left? What can we do? So the Buddha still is trying to offer, suggest a way to attend wisely, ask good questions that help you kind of find the path to liberation. And he suggests this is how you find the path. This is the questions to ask. One attends wisely as follows. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When a person attends wisely in this way, three entanglements are abandoned: personality view, doubt, and clinging to rules and observances. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. So here he is, what he offers as an alternative to the whole quest of self and understanding the self and finding a true self or finding a conventional self or an ultimate self or finding no self or all this kind of idea around self. What he's suggesting as an alternative is look at something that's much more immediate, something that's much more intimate almost, and that is in your own experience here and now. Notice where there is suffering or stress or tension. The word is dukkha. And then look for the origin of that, to understand the cause of that dukkha, that suffering. And then realize the cessation of that suffering, that cause and that suffering. And then follow a path that can make you do that. So this is the Four Noble Truths. And this is really the pillar or the foundation of the Buddha's teachings. And I think was part of his brilliance as a teacher was to offer a spiritual path that was not based on philosophy or metaphysics or ontology, that was removed from what we actually experience here and now. So there's no God that you have to believe in. And for some people, that God is self, right? And so there's no, you know, so even there's no, this whole question about self and finding the true self, in a sense, is avoided in this path the Buddha offered. And he suggested instead, drop down into your immediate experience and notice where your tension is. Notice where your suffering. Notice where the sense of stress is in your life. Take that seriously. And then investigate there and find where that can help you find freedom from it. The quest in Buddhism is to become free of suffering. And the starting point for doing that is suffering itself. The awakening of Buddhism is the awakening free of suffering. And so the most direct route to do that is to start with the suffering and look at that. If you start with philosophy, then you can go a really long time. You can go years and years. You can get a PhD in Buddhism, as I like to say, and not get any closer to answering that question. But you don't have to study at all, except studying yourself in the immediacy of your experience. Also, the issue of self is very important for us. Many of us, you know, do cling to self or have views about self, ideas of who we are. As we meditate, as the mind gets more mindful, more perceptive, more present, as we learn to leave ourselves alone in meditation, just be present, then we start seeing more and more in highlight the ways in which we don't let ourselves just be. We see more and more clearly the ways in which we cling to self-identity, we cling to conceit, we cling to views and ideas about who we are. We cling to ideas of what I need, what the self needs. And we also see the way in which out of this clinging to self-identity and ideas of who we are, it gives birth sometimes to a whole slew of our emotional life. There's a whole category of emotions that arise because we have first some idea of who we are, some clinging to a sense of self. So, for example, boredom sometimes can arise when what's happening in the world in some way doesn't relate to my cherished idea of who I am. Fear can arise sometimes when my sense of self is threatened, my self-identity, my self-image. Anger can arise when my self-image is frustrated. Certain types of joys can arise when our self-image is delightfully reinforced by reality. So, for example, if I win the California lottery, my cherished sense of self would be totally validated, and it just proves that I'm a wonderfully perfect person. You know, I can drive an expensive car, I can buy a big house, and I would just be just the greatest self, right? And that would just be the best. And so I could feel a lot of joy. So what I'm trying to point to is certain kinds of emotions arise because of this, we already have this clinging to self. And people will suffer a lot. A lot of suffering that people experience in the world has to do about how we are holding this idea, cherished idea of self. As we start looking, especially in meditation, we start seeing the places where the holding is. And it's not possible to go deep in meditation without beginning to shed some of the layers of clinging and holding around we have around self. And I would suggest that one of the most direct ways of shedding in a realistic way through understanding what we're doing in the process is by looking and studying the suffering and the clinging that gave birth to that suffering. If you have some idea of what your true self is, or some idea of what no self is, and you try to hold to the idea, then you're just substituting one kind of holding for another kind of holding. So a lot of Buddhist meditation practice, or Buddhist spiritual life, has to do with shedding, shedding and shedding the things that we hold on to. And then some people will... Then the question is, who are you when you've shed everything? And that becomes a very important question for some people because it can be very frightening to shed our self-image, self-identity, all these cherished clings we have to self, because that's the way people find their orientation in the world with other people. That's how they find that they're safe, or they kind of know who they are in the world. They have this reference point, me. You know, whatever you are, some kind of idea. And some of the ways in which we cling to self, we do because we think it's going to provide us with security or well-being or a sense of purpose or something. And so as the shedding process continues, it can be very frightening for some people. I've known people who've gone into panic because the idea of not having the protection of some idea of who I am is very, very difficult. So it should be entered. This whole process should be entered with great respect and great care. You shouldn't rush through the process because it's quite can be quite a challenge to really let go in a deep way. I remember there was a time in my practice where I could just see that what the practice was asking of me was to let go of some cherished idea that I was holding on to who I was. I could see it was asking me that, and it was like looking over a precipice. I could see it. I knew I had to, but you know, I wasn't going to go step over there, please. You know, it's bottomless. Nothing would hold me up. One image I have of practice like this is that. You come to a point, to an edge of a cliff, and you're asked to step off the edge. And it's, you know, look down, it's long, it's bottomless, it's almost bottomless. If it's bottomless, then it's safe, right, because you're not going to hit anything. But, you know, it's just a long way down. And so you come to the edge of a cliff and you're asked to take a step out into the abyss or into the void. And it doesn't seem safe. No way. But you're told you have to. So after a while, you finally trust your teacher. You say, okay, I guess this is it. I guess I'll die. But I'm told, this is what my teacher asked me to do this, so you take that step. And then as you take that step into the unknown, you let go of it. You know, your last holding to the ground. Then, magically, the cliff grows out and receives your next foot. But then you're asked to take the next step out. So you do. And then, magically, the cliff grows out, is there to receive you. So to let go of self. So none of this is meant to be a belief. As far as my understanding of teachings of the Buddha, the whole idea of self and not self is not meant to be beliefs at all, but rather a suggestion, your suggestion is just keep looking, keep getting still, keep being present, keep looking deeply, and you'll see very clearly what needs to be let go of, what needs to be let go of. And at some point you'll see very clearly that in your experience, here and now, that nothing makes, it doesn't make sense to take anything as the self. So it's not a belief or a view, it's something you'll see. You'll see that. Wow. I don't know where, I can look everywhere. Scan the horizon, scan within inside of me, and nothing makes sense to take as myself. So it's an empirical experience, not a view, an idea. So you're more than welcome to just wait patiently until that day comes. And then when that day comes, and you see that it doesn't make any sense to take anything as a self, then the suggestion is, stop trying to do it. Just let go. And be at ease, be at peace. So I hope that once and for all, you have freed yourself of a notion, maybe you never had it until tonight, but freed yourself of the notion that Buddhism teaches that there is no self. So what do you think? So what are your thoughts or comments to this or questions? Kate? Boredom? Well, boredom, what I was trying to do was say that there's certain ways, sometimes our emotions are triggered, or the condition for the arising of certain emotions is our sense of self, our self-concept. So sometimes if experience in life has no relevance to our self-concept, that can trigger boredom. If we get praised, I'm not bored. Get criticized, I'm also not bored. But if it has no relevance to myself at all, then, especially if I'm narcissistic, then, you know, like, everything has to relate to the self, right? So then it's really easy to get bored, because not everything does. It doesn't mean that all boredom comes out of a sense of self, self-clinging. But I think boredom often has a strong component part to that. Yes?
I guess my thought about the self is a concept, and it sort of limits my experience. And so if I stay with my experience and not with my ideas of what it might be, then it you know, then I'm going to have a more full experience, and I guess I won't be limited by just some idea I'm this or I'm that, which is craziness. That's it.
Yeah. So the definition I have for the self, it's like yours, is self is wind drag. Wind drag. Wind drag. So like, you know, you put your hand out the car window and you, there's wind drag. The self is wind drag. Because that's self, it's limiting, right?
Yes, limiting, yeah.
Can be. So over here.
I'm having a hard time buying it, frankly. I'm glad you asked what we thought. I guess I'm swayed by empirical evidence, I guess. And if I look at this experience and see not self as sort of a characteristic of all experience, then eventually it seems like I've gained enough empirical evidence to say there is no self.
Oh, you mean if
And I see what you're saying about clinging to it, but clinging to it seems like a separate thing. I could cling to the idea that clinging is the root of suffering, right. And then that too would cause me suffering. But it seems like before the clinging, to just have the felt experience that there is no self.
So after 10 years of looking at all your experience, you know, and you don't find any self after 10 years in your experience, then it's probably safe to say there is no self.
Right.
That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I mean, you could.
But why would you bother? why is it interesting?
I think it's interesting because to see that in experience is actually very freeing. So. You would bother in the same way, for the same reason that you would bother to see that that attachment causes suffering, because in seeing that there's some.
I'm not quite following. So to see that there is not see that there's nothing in your empirical experience that qualifies as itself. That's certainly freeing. But you find it also freeing to then generalize from that, and say, well. I can safely generalize. It's a safe generalization because statistically here, you know, for 10 years now, I see nothing else but this. So therefore, you find that then the generalization, therefore there is no self, you find that's helpful for you.
Yeah. I mean, I look for things in my experience to see whether or not something is like, you know, fundamentally true, uh-huh. Right? And there. Buddhism does seem to teach that there are a few things that are fundamentally true, that, and I think of them as those three things. You know,
it's possible, but I'd offer a different view of this, and I'm not going to say my view is fundamentally true, but I'll offer you a different view of this, and Buddhism is not meant to be physics, though some people want to see it as kind of physics. Buddhism is not trying to describe what reality is like. Buddhism has a very the Buddha had a very narrow interest when he taught, and that was how to free people from suffering. And so he had these strategies to help people do that. And one of the strategies was this deep mindfulness practice, that in the mindfulness practice, in the moment-to-moment experience of mindfulness. We see the three characteristics, one of them which is not self. Now, you could then come out of that deep meditative experience and make a conclusion that says, oh, this is the nature of reality. This is what I'm not, there is no self, or there's, you know. And that view could somehow be consoling for some people, it could be frightening for others. That view can help lighten things up and loosen up certain attachments to some degree. Be useful, but it's still a view. It's still relying on the view, and even though it might be a comforting view, the strategy of the Buddha, as I understand it, at least the strategy of Vipassana practice, is in Vipassana practice you want to be able to see very deeply the not self of the moment-to-moment experience. But the function of that seeing is not to come to a conclusion about reality. The function of that seeing is, in that seeing, deeply, to realize that it doesn't make sense to cling to anything as self. And then that's encouragement in that experience, while you're in that kind of state, to begin letting go of the deepest clinging that we have. And to do it so thoroughly that there's a radical, you know, just do it completely thoroughly. And that thorough shift, that thorough letting go that happens at the moment of liberation, that doesn't need to have a view or a story behind it. You know, it's like if you have a illness, you take the medicine, and when you're cured, you don't have to create a religion around the medicine. You know, you took the medicine, you know, and there's also the placebo effect and things. So am I making sense to you?
Yeah.
So the point of the not self is that it's a strategy that helps the mind let go. And once it succeeded in helping the mind letting go, you don't need to be concerned about is there a self or not a self. That's just kind of incidental. It's kind of interesting. I mean, it's not saying it's not interesting. It's kind of interesting. But your happiness is not dependent on that question. You know, then you can get a PhD. You know, look at all these different issues. So this is a very important point. So do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Is it satisfying, or are you now untroubled?
I'm like 95% convinced.
95%. It's hard being a teacher. Yes. It's actually very good to hear that. I like it when people don't agree with me.
Perhaps you might end up repeating your answer in the same way, but probably I'd like to hear that. The ultimate letting go is to let go of life itself, and yet, therefore, our existence, evolution, is based on survival instinct, procreation and such. So certain kind of clinging is sort of predetermined in our genetic makeup. Or is it just basically, like you say, is just a narrow interest to let one assist themselves to free the mind from suffering, as opposed to seeing the evolution as a fact of science?
So if I follow your question, the question is, are there biological conditions in being a human being that operate automatically, naturally? So if you're thirsty, you know, dying of thirst, then there's a strong desire for water to drink.
Yes. And then the biological, of course, is very highly related to the spiritual and mental and physical.
Yeah. And so the question, so there might be a strong, you know, physical, biological urge to drink if you're thirsty, or, you know, some.
And therefore the self, the need to nurture that self to survive.
The need to nurture the self to survive.
As opposed to total let go, which is basically going into a cliff and let go of life itself.
Yeah, some people do that. There's lots of stories in traditions of people who get really old and sick, great meditators, who decide that it's time. And so they go into meditation, and in the meditation they just let go completely of life itself. So some people do that. The issue here is maybe simpler. And the issue is not whether biology propels us to do, but the issue is, do we suffer? And so it's possible to be thirsty and not suffer. And I think you probably, even all people, maybe it's been some of you, have been in extremely trying situations and they've been able to not suffering because of it, you know, with it, been at peace in the midst of it. I've certainly been in difficult situations where I've suffered a lot, and I've been in the same kind of difficult situations where mind's been completely peaceful. And you would think that when there's strong physical pain, for example, that that physical pain comes with suffering. And it doesn't necessarily come with suffering. I've had intense joy and delight in my mind, rapture in my mind, while at times I have intense pain in my body. I've had times which my mind is completely serene and peaceful when there's been intense pain in my body. So so there are certain things that happen in the body, strong conditionings and movements, but does that necessarily translate into suffering in the mind? Now, I'm not qualified to give you a definitive answer to this question, but I just know that being on the path of looking at suffering, the causes of suffering, and letting go and finding that deep peace is deeply satisfying. And I believe not only is it deeply satisfying, I think it's a great gift to the world also to do that work.
But then that self need to be nurtured, and you have a responsibility, for example, to provide for your children, and therefore you have to go through a certain process of earning a living and such.
Right. So I don't take this body as myself. However, this body is very important to take care of. You know, I take care of my car. I try to get it serviced and, you know, get oil change and stuff like that, and I put gas in and various things. And I try to take care of it so it runs well. I need new tires now, so I'm thinking I should go get new tires. And this is all very important, right? So the same thing with this body. You know, I need to take care of it so it lasts for a long time. If this body is going to be a good vehicle for being on the path, for being of service to the world, this body needs to be well maintained and taken care of. And I don't need to see it as this is my body in some kind of essential way, or be clinging to it as my body. It's a body. It's the one that I seem to come with, and better or worse. But you know, so I take care of it, I have this mind. I take care of the mind. I don't necessarily see my mind as myself. I also, when I suffer, I don't necessarily see my suffering as myself either. There's suffering. I'll work with it and deal with it. If I'm at peace, at ease, I don't see that as my peace, my ease. In fact, even less so than I suffer, because when I'm deeply at peace, I can't find myself in that. It's like being transparent. It's like being empty. It's like being, it's kind of like, I don't know if it's like, but it's, you know, if you, a glass window that's so clean that you don't even see the glass. You know, just, you know, where is the self in this peaceful experience? And then someone comes along and says, "Gil, how do you feel?" Uh-oh. Okay, got to find that self a little bit, you know. Okay, I feel fine, thank you. But some, you know, it's a good question. It's a fair question. But, you know, occasionally when people ask me that question, I kind of, she's like, what? It doesn't quite compute for a moment. Yes.
I was interested about your feedback on the idea that there are different cultures that seem to not have a concept of self to begin with. Like
there are some what?
There's different cultures.
Yeah.
That seem to not have a concept of self, and that self is really the relationship to everything around them. Like the Australian Aborigines believe that they are the tree, that they are the water or the dirt, that they are just as
right.
equal a part of that.
Right.
And is that what the Buddha is talking about getting away from the idea that myself is apart from everything around me? And that if there's an example that we have of a society on Earth that seems to do that, it would be something like the Australian Aborigines? Does it just kind of take the whole question of self out of the picture?
Yeah, it takes the self out of the picture, in a sense. There are many different concepts of self that different cultures have. I don't know of any culture that has no concept of self. Maybe they exist, but I think most cultures have a concept of self. And it's very interesting to go live in different cultures and see how variable the self concept is. And if you only live in your own culture, it's almost inconceivable to imagine how radically different concepts of self are. And until you've kind of been outside your culture You take it as, you know, given, natural, as how the nature of the order of the universe was built around this particular concept of self. But, you know, it's a, you know, if you're an anthropologist, you realize that it's culturally conditioned. And so much of our suffering arises out of the culturally conditioned idea of who we're supposed to be. But you realize it's culturally conditioned. I mean, the anthropology is one of the vehicles to be a little bit free. Because you realize, oh, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be this way. So I don't know if there's any cultures without the concept of self. But this idea of seeing yourself, the self, in nature. You know, oh, I don't really exist separate from reality, but I am the tree. I am the animals, I am you. That's another view that some people form. And it's still, from the Buddhist point of view, it's still a concept of self. So he says, I'm going to read it as it says, but you can substitute the word earth with the word nature, for example. So a common person, someone who misunderstands, perceives earth as earth. Having perceived earth as earth, that person conceives himself as earth, or conceives himself in earth, or conceives himself apart from earth, or he conceives earth to be mine. He delights in earth. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So I think that here, you know, to see yourself as part of nature, you know, who I really am is I'm part of nature. I'm not separate from nature. That's also a view of self. And also not needed. And also kind of wind drag also gets in the way. And, you know, it's a great experience. It's a great kind of mystical experience to really have a sense of the self disappearing and really feeling yourself becoming one with a tree or an animal or someone else. It's really a great thing. But the fact that it's really great and feels really ultimate doesn't necessarily mean it's liberating. There's a lot of selves that want to leave. It's getting late, yes?
The microphone makes me not self-conscious. I'm using the Buddhist philosophy to understand what's happening with the rest of the world as I study myself. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what's happening now with the Islamic fundamentalists that are reacting to the cartoons in Denmark. And in some way I can understand that these fundamentalists are getting upset because their identity is so much attached to their beliefs. I can see it that way, and at the same time I can see that maybe it's not so much that, but it's the Western culture that's imposing the idea that this identity that we have created for ourselves in the West is moving and eating up that culture. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure, it makes some sense. And I don't really feel qualified to answer that question. I mean, there was an article I saw in the Chronicle this last yesterday, I think, about how what Europeans did to the Native Americans in America is now just being expanded out, you know, beyond this continent. Kind of the same kind of destruction and cultural clash. I don't know, but I do know that in all the different cultures that Buddhism has traveled to, you know, starting in India, Nepal, Tibet, China, ancient Afghanistan, and parts of ancient Greek, extended Greek Empire, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Laos, Burma, Korea, China, Mongolia, parts of Russia, Japan, and then the modern world, you know, everywhere else. Almost. This teachings of not self, of somehow looking through and seeing the ways in which we're identified and attached to self, seems to be deeply relevant. And that the understanding that how self-identity and holding to self is a cause of a lot of suffering, both for oneself and also out into others. So I would say that it's a universal thing, not culturally specific. Isn't that one culture doesn't have it? I think that probably all cultures embedded in people who are deeply attached to a sense of self, in some form or other, self-identity, and that when that it's clung to too tightly, it's very easy for that to spill out in forms of violence and disrespect for others. Is that good enough?
I just needed that little nudge.
Well, thank you. I hope that this was interesting or helpful.